From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood, Hollywood.
This week on The Business, agent turned manager turned producer Gavin Pallone, also known as the Dark Prince of Hollywood. He talks about his own amazing career and making the new documentary about his client, Conan O'Brien, Can't Stop. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood, Hollywood.
I'm joined by my fellow banterer, Rebecca Keegan of the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for John Horn. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, Kim.
So by the time we are being heard on the air or in somebody's earphones, the numbers for Green Lantern's opening will be known to the world probably. But we are surmising, based on tracking, that this picture, which is a big deal for Warner Brothers, is going to open to a pretty strong $60 million, right?
Right. This is a superhero movie starring Ryan Reynolds, and it is Warner Brothers' first attempt to launch one of these sort of secondary comic book characters. Of course, they have Batman and Superman, and now Green Lantern. They want to do basically what Marvel has done with a character like Iron Man, which is take someone known only in the geek universe and make him a blockbuster star.
And Marvel has done this incredibly well and very thriftily. And, you know, Warner Brothers, on the other hand, is not necessarily going to find it to be such easygoing with DC Comics, even though they very much want and need for that to happen. This is a high-stakes gamble, right?
Right. I mean, this is a movie that has a budget north of $200 million. And so far, the reviews coming in have been very poor, which is a big contrast to Iron Man, which was really well-reviewed and drew in people outside of just the sort of fanboy demographic who liked the wit of Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if the movie holds. You know, if it even has a reasonably strong opening, which it seems to be sure to have, do those reviews ever catch up to it? And it's almost like there's a backlash because I think the critics are so fed up with the whole comic bookization of Hollywood. The reviews are just almost, you know, in a frenzy of negativity. But, you know, sometimes these things transcend and become events.
That's right. And certainly that's what Warner Brothers is banking on. They hope to launch a franchise with this movie. That is why they've invested so much in it.
And speaking of comic book heroes, Comic-Con is scheduled in July. The Green Lantern was there last year promoting itself well in advance of its opening, obviously. But there was an interesting article in the New York Times this past week about a lot of studios deciding to pass on what had been a pretty mandatory event.
Yeah, there are going to be some notable absences at Geek Christmas this year. Warner Brothers is not bringing Dark Knight Rises or Superman, which are certainly two natural properties to promote at Comic-Con. Marvel Entertainment, which is arguably the Santa Claus of the whole event, will have a presence at Comic-Con, but is not doing the big presentation in Hall H, which is the giant room where footage is traditionally unveiled and sort of voted on by the members of the geek press. So it's going to be, I think, a different Comic-Con. It's not just that studios aren't going, because it's still early for them to announce their plans, but I think a lot of studios are going to San Diego, just not going to that Hall H room. Cowboys and Aliens will be doing a big screening outside of the convention center. There'll be some other events, just not in the traditional Comic-Con format.
Well, I talked to a publicist who has some experience with all of this stuff, and what he had to say was that after Scott Pilgrim, you know, Universal brought it last year, it played like gangbusters. And then, you know, the studio thought it had this giant hit because it was so deceived by that Comic-Con crowd and watched it just get brutalized. And the same thing happened the year before with Kick-Ass. And his take was they really have found that, you know, this is not necessarily the best expenditure, because if you truly have something like Dark Knight Rises, you don't necessarily need it. If you have something like Cowboys and Aliens, which is not a pre-established brand, then maybe it's worth it to try to get some buzz going.
I think the other takeaway, too, is that Comic-Con isn't a solution for a problematic movie. You can't just take a movie like Scott Pilgrim there, which had its certainly its fans, but also had its problems. And it's expect some sort of, you know, nerd glitter to fall all over it and make it a big hit. It's notable when you talk about Dark Knight Rises, there's one person who has never been to Comic-Con, and that's Chris Nolan, the director of that movie and of Inception. And I think the fact that he has never been there and his movies have been so wildly successful may have been a cue to his home studio, Warner Brothers, that they don't need to go.
So switching from fanboy to playboy, we had a little flat when the NBC Salt Lake City affiliate, KSL-TV, said they will not air The Playboy Club, which is this NBC show scheduled for the fall, because they think it's objectionable and inconsistent with NBC's brand.
You know, my first reaction to this, being a sort of naive person who doesn't cover TV that closely, was I didn't know that affiliates could say no to programming that came down from the network.
I actually got a chance to ask Robert Greenblatt, the new chairman of entertainment for NBC, about this. And he said this affiliate has the right not to air the show if they don't want to, but they also don't carry Saturday Night Live. So apparently they think that is inconsistent with NBC's brand, which is news to a lot of people, I think.
I mean, I would assume that Bob Greenblatt gets to decide what NBC's brand is for the foreseeable future.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Rebecca Keegan of the Los Angeles Times sitting in for John Horn. And in other news, next month we're partnering on an exciting event with the Peabody Award-winning storytelling series, The Moth. On Wednesday, July 6th, we'll co-host a story slam at Zanzibar, right here in Santa Monica. The theme is the business. The Moth is an open mic series with real people telling true stories live on stage. So come join us on July 6th to hear or tell stories about life in the industry. Go to kcrw.com/thebusiness for more information. About 8 months ago, Conan O'Brien returned to the airwaves with a new show on TBS.
Conan O'Brien!
That follows his very dramatic 2010 blow-up with NBC, the one that ended with O'Brien leaving his perch on The Tonight Show. No doubt you remember that that turned into the kind of media circus that's usually reserved for political sex scandals. Certainly, O'Brien won the PR war, rallying an army of fans under the Team Coco banner, while former NBC chief executive Jeff Zucker scrambled to defend himself. O'Brien walked away from NBC with a financial settlement worth millions, but the terms of the deal were that he couldn't appear on television for 6 months. So he and his creative team, namely his longtime executive producer, Jeff Ross, mounted Conan O'Brien's Legally Prohibited from Being Funny on Television tour. The new movie Conan O'Brien Can't Stop, which opens Friday in about 15 cities, documents what went on behind the scenes as O'Brien took his show on the road.
Oh, my.
What is it?
Oh, they just have barricades up because there's quite a few people out there.
Where do we go? I'm not going to bed.
Oh, no. You are not going out.
Yeah, I'm not. I can't go to bed. I'm not going to go home. Jeff, you don't get it. I can't go from this to doing what? Sitting and reading a Kindle? That's not going to happen.
Conan O'Brien Can't Stop was produced by O'Brien's longtime manager, Gavin Pallone. Pallone has a colorful history in the entertainment business. He started as an agent, turned into a manager after he was essentially drummed out of the agenting business thanks to his own terrible behavior. He then became a producer with credits including the movie Zombieland with Jesse Eisenberg and the TV show Gilmore Girls. At this point, Conan O'Brien is the only person that Pallone still manages. Conan O'Brien Can't Stop is Pallone's first documentary. It reveals a side of the comic that his fans may have never seen.
It's a whole other guy. We didn't want to make just another version of his television show. We wanted to reveal something. And the documentaries that I love most that are about, you know, people you've seen before reveal vulnerability and reveal distaste and things that you don't want to, that, you know, they're not going to expose to people.
That's sort of like, oh my God, he's a little high maintenance here.
A little?
Okay, a lot.
Yeah.
So, but that doesn't seem like an issue to you, Conan, Jeff, any of these people?
Not to me and Jeff. We were pretty resolute all the way through that this was going to work. A lot of people around Conan, other people that work on the show when they saw the movie, certain other people on the representative team were very anxious about it, very anxious. Everybody acknowledged as soon as they saw initial cuts of the movie that the movie was brilliant and just fantastic to watch and a great experience. But some people said, do we want to show this? Everything's going so well. It's going so well for Conan right now. He's overcome this, you know, debacle at NBC, and the people at TBS are fantastic to work with, and the show's great, and the numbers are great, and everybody's really happy. Why are we going to go do this? Well, we're going to show him act, you know, like sometimes. I knew this, and Rodman knew this, and I think Jeff was on board for this, was that making a good documentary would satisfy the fans more than just making something very puffy. And people, reading all the reviews and the reactions from everybody who's seen it, they love Conan. And one thing you see over and over again is, I wasn't such a big fan of Conan until now, and now I really am.
Mm-hmm. And he's fine with it, to the extent that he's fine with anything.
It's been a process. It's certainly been a process. I mean, he's just, you know, look, you've never met anybody whose focus can narrow, you know, so dramatically as him. You know, everything on the show. You can go, you know, there's one moment in the documentary that's particularly illuminating of his personality that other people now see that I've seen for, you know, 20 years, which is after the first show in Oregon, you know, they put the show together in 4 weeks. It's incredible. I go up and we do the first show in Eugene, Oregon, and, you know, everybody's nervous. Who knows what this is going to be? Are they going to pull this off? Place is sold out. And there's a lot of expectations. And, you know, the idea was, let's go to Eugene, Oregon and evade the press. Well, of course, everybody was there. And the show was a huge success. Cheering, standing ovations, everybody loved it. I run backstage. He's just coming out. And I feel like going, victory, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he looks like someone just passed him a note that his favorite uncle died. And I'm like, dude, what the hell is going on? You know, and he's just in a funk, probably because something none of us saw didn't work exactly the way he wanted it to work, which is part of why he's so great. But, you know, it's ponderous to have to deal with it all the time. I mean, he is a perfectionist beyond perfectionist and tortures himself. And then, as you'll see in the movie, tortures everybody else around him sometimes.
So how's he feeling and how are you feeling about the show on TBS?
Great. I mean, first of all, they're not like other people. Steve Coonan, who runs TBS and TNT and Cartoon Network and the others, sets a tone that's just not like everything else because he's not from here. You know, he lives in Atlanta. They're based in Atlanta. He comes from Coke. Whatever he tells you he's going to do, he does and more. He's going to say, I'm going to market this like bigger than you can ever imagine. And then he goes further than what we could ever possibly imagine, you know. And they've been nothing but supportive. I don't remember any notes. I don't know. I mean, they're just a delight compared to the prior regime at NBC, which is just like, you know, a cage full of lobotomized monkeys. So what's there not to like about it? It's just been fantastic.
So now that the smoke is cleared, if I went to you or Conan and said, okay, would you rather have prevailed in the PR fight and go on to TBS, or would you just rather go back and do The Tonight Show?
Oh, he'd rather go to TBS. Not because TBS is a better venue or anything like that, but because the people at TBS, the executives at TBS have been fantastic. I think there was something he was locked into, which is the idea of The Tonight Show and the chimera of its importance to the American public. And that probably was a little bit of an old school kind of idea that somebody who's in their 40s might have, but younger people don't even know what you're talking about because they don't know. I hate to say it, but, you know, a 30-year-old doesn't really know who Johnny Carson is. And they certainly don't know who Steve Allen or Jack Paar are. And, you know, Conan grew up with that. He was a student of it. He was focused on it since he was a child.
Right.
You know, Johnny Carson's his hero. David Letterman's his hero. So he had a skewed point of view. And I think after everything happened at NBC, I think it shifted that point of view and he saw it for what it was. And now, I mean, I think he's as happy as it could be and the audience loves it and everything's great.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Gavin Pallone, Conan O'Brien's manager and the producer of the new documentary, Conan O'Brien Can't Stop. Pallone was an agent and then a manager before focusing on his career as a producer. As he underwent that transition, he dropped all his clients with one exception. And the two go way back. When Pallone signed him, O'Brien wasn't famous, but he was being hotly pursued.
It was a derby of gigantic proportions because he was a very hot writer. And I think there were about 8 different agents, and he was very deliberate about, he had left somebody and wanted, you know, to be really sure about the next choice. And, you know, there were a lot of meetings with him. Also, I had seen him perform And he had been saying, you know, after the Simpsons contract's over, I don't want to make an overall deal on the Simpsons, which was what everybody else was doing. And it was where I'd made most of my money. You know, I'd booked all these people, writers I had represented on these hot shows like the Simpsons and Seinfeld into huge overall deals, and they all had cashed in. It was a different time in television where you could do that. And that was set up for him. I mean, there was a big overall deal for Conan because he was such a hot writer. And he said, I don't want to do any of that. I want to become a performer. And I had gone to see him perform a couple different times. And I don't know that the other Asians had. And so as a result, he knew that I was speaking about, you know, something I had seen before. And I guess he trusted the sincerity of what I had said, which was, fine, we'll figure out a way for you to be on camera when you leave The Simpsons. And, you know, I held to that and it kind of worked out. I didn't know it would work out to this extent, but it never works that way. You know, it's what you think is going to happen doesn't usually happen. You know, when I was an agent and I signed Larry David, Seinfeld had already been written and produced and I had never seen it. I had read a screenplay of his that I thought was great. And I thought, you know, here's a guy I could get a lot of screenwriter jobs for, rewriting jobs. That was what I thought.
That's what he was going to do.
Yeah, he's a guy. I could probably start booking him for 150, 200 grand for a rewrite. He makes 600,000 a year. That'd be great. That's what I thought.
I have to ask you. I mean, you were an agent. That ended badly. The split with the United Talent Agency, which led to litigation. Then you became a manager. Now, was that a decision that you made because you hated being an agent or because they hated you being an agent? Or?
There was a very smart reason for me to become a manager, which was no one would hire me as an agent.
That's what I was trying to move towards slowly.
Yeah, yes. So it's nice of you to be so delicate about it.
I was trying to be delicate.
No, nobody would hire me. I had started at ICM and they fired me. And then I was at UTA and then they fired me. And then no other agency would want to hire me. And then what was left? And the answer was to become a manager.
I am wondering, what went wrong looking back with these agency jobs? Why?
Me.
Well, yeah, okay.
I was impossible. I was a jerk.
What motivated you to be a jerk? And in what way did your jerkishness manifest itself?
I was unparented. You know, I graduated from college early, so all my friends were still in school. And I started working immediately. And, you know, I started doing well pretty quickly. And I mean, I just worked all the time. I took a total of 4 weeks vacation in my first 6 years working. I worked, you know, late every night. I'd read scripts all weekend long. So I had no perspective. The only people I was around were my coworkers. And in a sense, I was in a competitive environment with them and they were all much older than I was. So, you know, and nobody was ever my mentor. Nobody would ever say, hey, why don't you calm down? So everything was just, I've got to get more. I've got to fight harder. You're screwing me. And I always had that opinion. And as I did better and better, I kept this one point of view, which is I'm working harder than you, older person who started the agency in some cases. And I would really rub their nose in it. And I would attack all the time. And, you know, I think it came from actually underneath it all feeling very vulnerable, but I acted very arrogantly. And I was always very demanding. And the part about it that bothers me most is I just wasn't enjoying my life when I should have been. You know, when you're 28, 29 years old and you're making a lot of money, you know, and driving fancy cars and dating attractive women, like that's the dream. And I was miserable. I was always angry at the people with whom I worked because I felt like they weren't working as hard as me and I deserved more. You know, you get into that kind of thing. And I was probably rewarded for it because I would go and be threatening. I'm going to leave and take all my clients with me if you don't do what I say. And then they would, you know, just give me more money. So it was just a bad cycle. And it was bad for me personally. I lived with a lot of anger, which is unpleasant. And I was just obnoxious and overly aggressive with the people with whom I worked.
Coming up after a short break, why Gavin Pallone has a reputation as Hollywood's Dark Prince. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Producer Gavin Pallone's latest movie is the documentary Conan O'Brien Can't Stop, which chronicles the comedian's roadshow following his very high-profile departure from NBC. The movie reveals a darker side to O'Brien, which normally is seen only by those closest to him, people like Gavin Pallone, who is O'Brien's longtime manager. Pallone is hardly a stranger to darkness. In fact, he's known in the business as the Dark Prince of Hollywood. He also has a well-established reputation for his exacting ways, from a strictly limited diet to a rigorous physical fitness regimen. As we discussed earlier, Pallone began his career as a demanding, arrogant agent whose behavior got him fired from not one but two agencies, despite having been a top earner. By his own account, he became a manager because no agency would hire him. A few years later, he reinvented himself as a producer with credits including the movie Zombieland and the long-running TV series Gilmore Girls. Pallone says he's mellowed since his earlier days, but an animated short that made the virtual rounds in Hollywood just last year reveals that he's still not easy. Made by a former Pallone assistant, it's called Gavin Pallone is the Bane of My Existence. You can watch it on our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness. It's one of those monotone cartoons, and though it doesn't paint a flattering picture, Pallone admits it's not entirely untrue.
I should have never hired an Asian assistant. You are worthless. Also, you lie all the time, and I'm pretty sure you're stealing from me.
I'm not Asian. I don't look Asian. I'm white. Get me out of here.
I'm literally so tired I might cry. I went home last night and immediately went to the gym for 6 hours. Then I woke up at 4 and went to the gym. I'm just so exhausted from working out and being awesome.
Well, there's elements of
you're
it.
Sort of,
it's based. It's kind of like actually when people come and say, "Is Larry David really like that?" And I say, "Yes, but not compressed into 29 minutes." You know,
okay.
Like Larry is capable of all of these things. You know, once a year, or when people ask me about Ari Emanuel, who I know very well and I'm good friends with, and they go, "Is he like the guy on Entourage?" And I go, "Yes, but it doesn't happen like one crazy thing happened, then another, and then another. Like once a year, you'll see an element of that." And I would say that cartoon, which was very funny, and you know, when she did it, I encouraged her to do it, and she showed it to me, and I gave her notes, and I think the notes were basically to make
you
it
encouraged
meaner.
Her to do it.
Well, it was funny.
Okay.
She was said, "I'm going to do this," and I was like, "Great." And then she showed it to me, and I thought, "Well, why don't you do this or that?" And just things that would make it meaner and funnier, and it's pretty funny, I think.
I mean, The Dark Prince—that's like one of your little sobriquets, I think, out there.
And, I didn't say that.
But if you Google yourself and Dark Prince, you'll get some hits. And
Conan says that a lot, yeah.
And this is a quote your friend John Turteltaub, the filmmaker, said about you a few years ago. "There's a lot of freedom that comes when you abandon the need to be loved. Sometimes the word for that is sociopath. On the other hand, the word is sometimes artist." Mm-hmm. Do you recognize that as being about you now?
Yeah, I don't care what anybody thinks about me.
So
I care about when the people I like think about me, I guess. But, you know, there's very few of them, so I don't have to worry too much about it. I don't like very many people.
How many fingers do you need to count them?
To be honest, I have very few friends. You know, when you're a 47-year-old single guy,
right,
you're not really socializing with anybody. Most of my male friends are married. I'm not going to go hang out with a bunch of young guys, you know, go to bars and meet people. I don't want to date. It's like...
At all?
I don't know. How can okay. I sit and talk and hear someone bitch about their mother? I don't know.
No, okay. You're not up for that.
No. So it's like I'm kind of in an odd situation. So then, and then everybody else is just a business person. And what I've learned over the years is if I'm just genuine about who I am and not really try to restrain what I think or what I say, it probably works better for me. When I think I'm wronged, I fight back. So I end up getting into a lot of legal scrapes with the people who might employ me. And what ends up happening is they continue to employ me.
You had the Gilmore Girls litigation, right? You sued, what is it, Warner Brothers?
I sued Warner Brothers and, you know, I saw the people at Warner Brothers yesterday and Conan's deals at Warner Brothers and I go and talk to those people about movies all the time. I don't know if, I think I'm banned from doing television over there, but whatever. You know, I work at HBO where I have a great relationship, which is their sister company. I have great relationships on the Turner side of it. So it's like, and I never have a problem. I think I've threatened to or started to sue Fox a couple different times, and then I'll go sell another show to them. That's just a method of working it out. I know that I can't live with myself by just sweeping something under the rug or letting something go. It's just not my particular personality, which is what made me a good agent because I was an advocate for people when they were wronged, and I think that they responded positively to it. The one or two times I've ever let anything go, I've internalized it and I continue to think about it. When I was fired from ICM, they owed me a bonus. This was 1989. I still think about the fact that they owe me that bonus, that I let them, and I went and I was going to like, I could go after them. State law says they owe me my bonus. And then somebody said, "Hey, you know what? It's already been tumultuous enough. Why don't you just let it go?" And I like everybody at ICM, and I like even the people that fired me. But it's still in my head that I let that one go. And so for me, I just don't believe in that. If I had a problem with you, Kim, you would know about it. I don't stab anyone in the back, and I don't like keep anything a secret. I'm very honest about who I am. And I think pursuing something until the logical end is part of that.
So just returning to the legend, which is apparently based in fact, this article in the Times in 2003 said you were called a freak, a misanthrope, the quintessence of evil, and that by people who like you. What do you think when you hear that and read that?
I understand why anybody would say any of those things. You know, I sometimes, everything for me, again, is trying to have perspective, and I zoom out from my own life and I go, God, what a weird life I lead. I'm not like anybody else. I've never felt like I was like anybody else. And now it's even more odd.
Because you mean you're older and people are married or?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't have any friends that live my life. You know, I just got back. I was in Las Vegas for the last 9 days playing poker. No friend of mine would do that. I have friends that go, God, I'd love to go do that, but I can't. You know, it's my kid's soccer game or whatever. So, you know, I go do a lot of stuff like that. And I don't know. I just, I live a very solitary, strange kind of, you know, I live the kind of life of a rich serial killer, I guess. You know? I'm by myself all the time.
You are, in fact, a sociopath.
I don't think so because sociopaths, I think, don't feel. And I feel things, you know. I think I am emotional and I can be hurt and I have connections to things. But
I think,
you know,
if you feel remorse or something, right? If you feel remorseful for your actions, you're not a sociopath.
I certainly feel remorseful for certain actions of mine. So I don't think I'm clinically a sociopath, but I think I'm weird. You know, here's the other side. I'm happy. I look at my life and I go,
you feel happy.
I'm really happy.
Okay.
And I'm so grateful about my health and the fact that I'm, and my own, you know, honestly, my physicality, because I exercise a lot. I'm very in control of my diet and things like that. And I get a great deal of satisfaction from the fact that I'm aware of how healthy I am.
Like, you are really rigid about the diet.
Yeah, I'm rigid about a lot of things like that. But what it yields for me is very valuable. And so having that and having control over
energy or health or both?
I don't know. Most people have a back problem. Most people can't do what I can do, you know. The place where I get more approbation than anywhere else is in the gym. People coming up to me, God, how do you run like that? You know, because I'm obviously an old man, but, you know, they're like, oh, I can't run like that. I can't do that many pull-ups. I can't, you know, do the splits or whatever. It's, you know, these things that I can do. And I feel like the
you
fact
can do
that
the splits, I have no idea. Go on.
The fact that I focus on myself affords me certain other things. The fact that I went to Las Vegas for 9 days, played the World Series of Poker, and the only thought I have is like, I just wish I could have stayed for the whole 6 week run of the series is pretty great. And you know what else? I don't take it for granted that I have financial resources, and I don't take it for granted that I've had success in my career and that I can pick and choose what I want to do. That sometimes things come up where I might be able to make money and I say, I don't want to do that because I don't think it'll be fun or interesting for me. And then I can make a different kind of a choice.
Gavin Pallone is a producer of TV shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm and Gilmore Girls, and of movies including Zombieland and Panic Room. His latest is the documentary Conan O'Brien Can't Stop. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Conan O'Brien Can't Stop opens Friday, June 24th. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. To leave a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness or post on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business, where we'll also be posting information about a live event we're doing with The Moth on July 6th in Santa Monica. In the meantime, you can listen to us online at kcrw.com or on your phone with the KCRW iPhone and Android apps. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.